And tradition has it that most of the Psalms were written by David. And David lived, as you know, probably about 1,000 years before Jesus, so about 3,000 years ago. And David was the first ruler to unite a smattering of warring tribes there in the plains of Jordan into a unified kingdom called Israel. And then his son Solomon, who went on to become king, would go on to build the first temple, giving Judaism its lighthouse, its anchor, its citadel, a temple where the Holy of Holies and the temple priests breathed the same air, and where the seeds of Judaism took root and bore much fruit. And so it was in that prolific time of growth, of birth, of Genesis, that most of the Torah and the other significant sections of the Hebrew Bible were written down. The Hebrew Bible, known as the Tanakh, or in Christianity known as the Old Testament. And like the books of the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Numbers, the Psalms were forged in the fire of war, in the fire of battle, of struggle. And there are a lot of significant themes in those early Bible texts. But I think foremost among those themes is this: how to live a peaceful life in the midst of conflict, war, and death. How to find stillness. I mean, this is how the Bhagavad Gita might put it. How to find stillness in the field of action. How to be both engaged in the world fully and yet maintain one's stillness and centeredness in the eternal, in the atemporal, in the immaterial. So look, no religion has cornered the market on misery and on suffering. It's something that we all understand, but for 3,000 years, I think people of all faith traditions have turned to the Psalms for the solace that they find there in the haunting power of those poems. And these world-weary songs sing out across the plains of Jordan and down through the ages with universal authority. And anyone with a heart feels at home in their seasoned knowledge of the human experience. Even if the God of Abraham is not your preferred personification of the divine. And a lot of us grew up and had to kind of come back to the Bible because for many of us it associated some unpleasant things, exclusion. And that's a beautiful journey. So take the 46th Psalm, for example. Now, no one knows who wrote the 46th Psalm. Like I said, David wrote most of them, but a lot of them we don't know who wrote it. But like most of the Psalms, the 46th Psalm seems to have been inspired by some really dark and chaotic events. And like the other Psalms, it sings of a God who stands by us while all else falls around us in rubble. So the 46th Psalm paints a bleak picture of a world at war where, quote, nations are in uproar and, quote, kingdoms fail. Sounds like the news. Yet despite the, quote, desolation, God, quote, makes war cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow, and he shatters the spear, and he burns the shields and chariots with fire. What an interesting prayer for a soldier to pray. What an interesting song for a soldier to sing, that all the machinery of war are melting by God's power. But it's the next line that everybody remembers. In the midst of all this chaos, as God is wresting peace from the jaws of war, God says, "Be still and know that I am God." Be still and know that I am God. So what does it mean to be still? Stillness means coming out of the field of action and leaving the world to its own processes for a while. It means non-interference. It means no words, no talking, no writing, no singing. It means slipping the noose of the busy mind. It means coming into the stillness that lies just beneath the agitated waves of our surface consciousness. Now, in his classic of Vedanta philosophy, the Yoga Sutra, Patanjali defines yoga as, quote, the cessation of the thought waves of the mind, or the stilling of the thought waves of the mind. That's kind of a similar idea. And all of this reminds me again of the Bhagavad Gita, another book about war, by the way, or metaphorically speaking, about the field of action in which we find our lives. And Krishna, the great teacher of the Bhagavad Gita, insists that our actions in the outer world must be rooted in the deep and abiding stillness within, the Atman, the infinite universal soul, what Emerson called the oversoul, the infinite ground of being, undying, changeless, boundless. That's what we carry with us. That is our core. And while we engage in the field of action, we must be rooted in that inner space of stillness. So both the Gita and Vedanta point to the ever-present stillness within. And in this view, we are at core Brahman Atman, the One, or in the language of Ernest Holmes, God. This formless reality from which all forms arise and to which all forms return. And we lose touch with our own essential stillness when we turn outward and get caught up in the machinations of the world and the agitation of the thought stream with its concepts, cravings, fears, and judgments. This pulls us out of our center. And we regain our footing when we turn again toward the stillness within. Now, Hinduism and Judaism have very different theological constructs regarding the nature of ultimate reality, at least on one level. But they both agree, stillness is what ultimate reality feels like. Now let's turn to the 23rd Psalm, which is the most famous and beloved psalm of all, number one on the greatest hits album of psalms. You know, though I walk through the valley of the shadow, right? Okay, that one. It's a doozy. That's why everybody remembers it. This one is by David. It's kind of nice when your king and military leader is a poet. We don't see much of that anymore. And it is, of course, the masterpiece of realizing peace in the midst of conflict. And I'm going to read it to you from the New International Version, not the King James, which is nice too, but I like this one. The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely, your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever and ever. First of all, look at the central metaphor, a sheep and his shepherd. That's what it's about. And this is a natural image or a natural direction for David to take, because not only are the Israelis herdsmen, largely, but I think he undoubtedly sees himself as a shepherd gathering together his flock for the first time into this united kingdom. And the metaphor is, of course, about our relationship with God. God as the shepherd, and we as those protected and provided for by God. And although the world is a hard, hard place, God makes sure that we lack nothing. We have green grass, we have calm waters, we are refreshed, and we are guided along new paths, along right paths, by His presence within us and by His visibility outside us in these great and beautiful works. Our simple needs are met. We are safe. We are always home, no matter where we are. What an archetypal, undying truth that psalm embodies and conveys. And after all that bucolic beauty, the green pastures and the calm waters and stuff, we are also reminded, I think, toward the end of the psalm, that not every problem has been solved. I love that line. That's my favorite line. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. Not you smite my enemies dead, or you make all my enemies into my friends. It doesn't say that. It says you prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. And what I take from that is that conflict will always be with us. And to stop childishly wishing for a world without conflict. Conflict will always be with us. And the best we can hope for is temporary respite. A feast where we can break bread together and celebrate our common humanity. You know, the Dalai Lama says it this way, peace does not mean an absence of conflicts. Differences will always be there. Peace means solving these differences through peaceful means. That's different. Peace means solving these differences, navigating these differences through peaceful means, through dialogue, communication, education, and through humane ways. End quote. So in that sense, peace is not the destination. We don't imagine a utopia and then resent that we're not there, forever denigrating the present reality as an incomplete place in our fantasy of utopia. That's not the concept of peace I get from this psalm. Peace is the process, not a way of being in the world. Perhaps it's time that we kind of matured on this question of peace then and grew into a deeper vision of peace. No more should we cling to this kind of naive romantic notion that there will one day be a world without conflict. As the Dalai Lama said, peace is not the destination, peace is the process. This is how Thich Nhat Hanh says it. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. It's a really profound statement, I think. There is no way to get to a thing called peace. Peace is the way you move through your life. Peace is the way we move and navigate through conflict. So peace must be built in the presence of conflict, not in its absence. And where is peace to be found? It is to be found in the stillness within. For when we learn how to be still, answers arise, solutions appear, and animosities soften. It is in stillness that our hearts grow calm. It is from stillness that our wisdom comes. And it is through stillness that the order of our life is restored. In Buddhism, this stillness is called nirvana, which literally means no wind. No movement, stillness. The Buddha taught that when we leave behind the agitation of craving and fear, we arrive at a place of serenity and peace, where empathy and loving kindness and generosity of spirit replace the miserly competitiveness that used to characterize our lives. And we are now able to weather the presence of our enemies without reaction, because we have transcended the consciousness that divides the whole of humanity into friends and enemies. So too, of course, and we're all thinking of this already, I don't even need to say it, do I? But when Jesus says, love your enemies, isn't that what this is all about? That Jesus points to a field out past all concepts of wrongdoing and rightdoing, where people with different understanding and where people with different understandings of the world, temporarily in conflict with one another, meet and move into a mode of living that recognizes differences but is not limited to or bound by them. Yet, none of this, you know, enlightened consciousness from all these lovely traditions is available to an agitated mind. It's all just blah, 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 blah. There is just too much adrenaline coursing through our veins most of the time. We're quick to anger, in constant judgment, slow to forgive. But there is a path forward out of this morass, and it is simply stillness. Only through stillness and serenity is our adrenaline slowly reabsorbed, allowing us to shift into the quietude that is our sacred birthright, our cosmic home. So no matter which tradition you ascribe to or to none at all, this primal ocean of peaceful insight, as Muhammad says, is nearer to us than our jugular vein. We have only to slow down, slip out of the thought stream, and gather our wits into a pool of stillness. We do it very nicely here. We just did it. We're going to do it some more. We do it when we meditate. We do it when the beauty of nature stops us in our tracks, or when we hold a baby and we can't speak from the mystery and glory of it all. Those are the stillness moments kind of bubbling up through the surface. So please repeat after me. It is in stillness that our hearts grow calm.
It is from stillness that our wisdom comes.
And it is through stillness that the order of our life is restored. Namaste, everybody.